I'm fine with that, thank you.
Didn't send me any pictures.
I'm going to...
It'll be really soon.
I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Early Childhood and Family Supports to order for Thursday, February 23rd. So we're going to start off with an informational hearing on early interventions in special education. We have three panels, I believe. And so, Judy, are you in the first panel? Okay, if the first panel would come forward, and before you speak, just introduce yourself for the record. I would appreciate that. And the group may decide as we're going through to ask questions, and I hope that's okay with all of you.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and committee members. I'm Nancy Johnson-Dorn, and I'm the director of the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program at Oregon Department of Education in the Office of Student Services. We want to thank you so much for inviting us to come and speak with you today. We're really excited to tell you about our Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program, which is a mouthful, so you will
hear us say
EI, and you'll hear us say ECSE. And sometimes some of us say it really fast. So,
and some of us just say EIEIO. People know what we mean.
If you give us permission, we will.
People know what we mean.
It's just a big mouthful of words. We have a number of people here today to give you a description of our program. I will give you an overview of the program, and then you will hear about how children are referred for our services, what services look like, what outcomes we're looking for with children. And we also have a group of parents here today that will talk to you about their experience with the EI-ECS program. Early intervention, early childhood special education is a special education program for children with developmental delay, disability, or for kids under age three, a condition likely to result in delay. These services are provided to all kids who qualify. It differs from other state-funded programs in that there are no family income requirements, and all children who meet the requirement for delay or disability or a child likely to result in a disability, receive services at no cost. The EIECS program is a state-operated program, and it's operated by Oregon Department of Education through the Office of Student Services. The Office of Student Services oversees all special education programs in Oregon, but it has additional responsibility for the EI-ECSE program in that we have direct responsibility for providing appropriate services to children and families. We do this through nine contracts, eight with education service districts and one with a school district. Services are provided in every county in the state, either directly by the contractor or through subcontracts with local ESDs, school districts, and we have one university-affiliated program. So if you take a look at this slide, I'm going to talk about the area in the yellow. All of the different areas represent the nine different contractors that we have and the nine different areas that we break into services. But the yellow is operated by High Desert ESD. And High Desert ESD is located in...
based out of Redmond.
I am just blanking on this. Redmond. Yes. Excuse me. I wanted to say Bend. It's in Redmond, and they provide direct services to children in Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson counties. They subcontract with Harney ESD for services in Harney County, and they subcontract with North Central ESD to provide services in Sherman, Gilliam, and Condon County. And North Central ESD is in Condon. Another example on here is the orange.
Excuse me, could you move the mic just a little bit closer? We're having a hard time recording.
Sorry, I thought you could hear.
Well, sometimes, that's right.
Can you
sometimes
hear me now,
you say
or do
you're
I need to bring it down? Can you hear me?
Bring it down just a hair, maybe.
There is that go. Better?
That's great.
Perfect.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So in the orange, that's operated by Northwest Regional ESD out of Washington County, and they provide services directly to Columbia, Clatsop, Tillamook, and Washington counties. And then you can see the other configurations. Lynn Benton, Lincoln County provides services in those counties, and then also in Coos and Curry. Services to children are individualized and vary between children based on their special education needs. Some children require services in all developmental areas, and other children require services in just one area, like speech therapy for kids with speech delays. Early intervention services are for infants and toddlers with disabilities and are mostly provided in the child's home or at child care. The focus is on teaching the family strategies to promote the child's learning throughout the day. Early childhood special education services are provided to older children in community preschools like Head Start, Oregon Pre-Kindergarten, and Preschool Promise, or in specialized preschools that are operated by the Early Childhood Special Education Program. Services range from direct instruction by special education teachers to providing coaching to teachers in community preschools to implement specific learning strategies. The focus is on teaching children lagging skills in order to increase their likelihood of success in school. Services that children receive depend on their special education needs, and they might consist of occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy, speech and language skills, and specialized equipment is sometimes what kids need. The program is funded through state and federal funding, and as you can see from this slide, 78% of the funds for this program come through state general fund as grant and aid into the program, and 21% through federal funds. And we have about 1% through Medicaid reimbursement. These services make a difference for kids in our program. This is actually a graduate from our program. She's in middle school right now. Services are meant to be provided as soon as the child is identified in order to minimize the impact of their disability on their learning. These services increase each child's potential for lifelong success and can prevent the need for more costly special education when they get to school. Child outcome data are collected at child entry and child exit from the program for children that have been in the program for at least 6 months. And we collect child outcome data for both kids in early intervention, the birth to three-year-olds, and children in early childhood special education, the 3 to 5-year-olds. Child outcome data are collected on assessment items like some of the following, pointing to objects and people. For young kids, the birth to three-year-olds, demonstrating functional use of reading, like turning the pages in a book, or responding appropriately to a parent's interaction. So responding appropriately to a child's, to a parent's smile, to their voice, towards their initiation of play with the child.
Excuse me, could I ask a question?
Yes.
So the outcomes, are the outcomes dictated by the people providing the funds, or how are the outcomes?
The outcomes are dictated by the federal government, and they break them into 3 different buckets of skills, and then there is different levels that we report to them. I just picked one level, and I picked just 2 of the buckets to show you, because it's a lot of data. So
thank you.
So for early intervention child outcomes, this slide shows the percentage of kids that narrowed or closed the developmental gap or increased the rate of learning while in the program. And so the graph on the left-hand side for social-emotional skills shows that over the years, we hover right around 80% of the kids increasing their skills or increasing their rate of learning during their time in their early intervention program. And in cognitive and communication skills, just around 60% over the years. For children in early childhood special education, assessment items include watching, listening, participating during large group activities like story time, understanding color, shape, and size concepts, and resolving conflict by using an effective strategy. So an effective strategy might be moving away from a group when there's conflict. This slide is the same kind of slide as the other one, showing the percentage of kids that narrowed or closed the achievement, the developmental gap, and increased their rate of learning during their time in the early childhood special education program. And you can see in the social-emotional skills that there's a gradual slight decline over the years, and cognitive and communication skills kind of bounce around at the same level.
And so those level, is there a target at which you're evaluated by achieving or not achieving?
There's a target that we set ourselves in the state, but the target really is 100%. We'd like all kids to be able to increase their learning rate while they're in the program.
Thank you.
These services are mandated by federal and state law, meaning that every child who qualifies receives services. There are no wait lists. The program adjusts to accommodate the increasing number of kids, and the numbers of children qualifying for service continues to increase, as illustrated in the next slide. So this slide shows both, I don't know if my pointer works. It does. It shows growth across the year from September to August, and then it also shows growth from year to year. And you can see from the slide we start every fall much lower than we end in August. And that's because we have a number of kids that move on to kindergarten, and so we lose a number of kids out of the program at that time. Oftentimes, a child's delay is not noticed until they enter preschool, and we see increased numbers of kids referred in the late fall by our early childhood partners like Head Start, Oregon Pre-Kindergarten, and Preschool Promise.
So given the fact that there is no waiting list and you have to serve every child, I'm trying to understand the connection that has then to the budget process of the state and or the federal government, how that works, because I assume going in there's a set budget.
There is a set budget. And what happens as we get more kids, we just expand or try to accommodate. Not try to. We accommodate every child who comes in because we have to serve every child. And so that means accommodating across the needs of all kids. It's probably the best way to describe that. And I can show a little bit about the funding and what happens with our funding.
Great. Thank you. Representative Hayden, please.
Thank you, Chair Lively. I do have a question on that, whether it's appropriate now or later. The school districts obviously are split up by, I'm assuming, population, and you put counties into them, the previous page 6 slide there. But while I was looking at that, I was wondering, do we as a legislature, through you, look at that not just based on within normal limits childs or whatever, however you term that in education terms, not medical terms?
Yeah.
Do you look at those as far as the populations that would qualify for, right? Because there might be, I don't know, do we look if there's a significant difference in one school district for that population need versus a different school district, and do we adjust funding for that? Because one school district might, I mean, if you had...
I think I understand your question. When we look at funding, so we get money from the state legislature, we get our federal funds, and we put those monies into a pot, and then we look at how we divvy those up among the different contractors. And we usually do that based on child count, a number of kids that are in the program, and then during the second year of the biennium, we always adjust because some places grow faster than others. We also have some mechanisms that if a program has a particular need, like a sudden growth in children with autism or other high needs kids that cost more money, we try to adjust and give and allow more funds in that way.
So, follow up.
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you. So, to follow up on that, do you allow funds from one school district to another school district? Is there a process for that? Say there's a greater demand in, you know, in number three versus number five. Well, there's a greater
demand. We reconcile that during the next year funding.
But not during, not out of
not their, during the year.
Just in additional budget.
And usually what we try to do is in the first year of funding from the biennium is to use 49% of our funds and hold some money back for the second year for growth. And then we adjust in that second year. But it gives us some more money to adjust when there might be more growth or higher need in the different areas. But we don't have a lot of money to play with to do that.
No, I think we should get you more money. But.
Huh?
Okay.
I'll go on record. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to jump ahead if you've got a slide, but my longtime superintendent of High Desert, you know, this is one of John's things that he's always been on. And I honestly don't know if John has retired yet or not. I know Paul's getting ready to take over. But anyway.
He's here right now, but he's in another meeting.
Okay. Okay. He's talked about the program need growth, student population growth. This shows, you know, part of a school year growth, but from biennium to biennium, over the last two or three biennia, have we seen a greater need? And we've tried to put more money, you know, through the Ways and Means process, and I know this isn't a subcommittee, but kind of curious, you know, where we are and maybe what the presentation to the Education Subcommittee is going to be budgetarily for this to make sure that we are getting the right amount in there. We don't want our school districts to be mandated to provide certain services and then create an unfunded mandate.
Okay. Chair Lively and Representative Huffman, as you can see in this slide, it shows, oh, darn it. There it is. You can see the difference between the orange and the blue in September. That kind of sets the stage going into the next, that next year. And you can see the growth. Those comparisons show you how we grow every year since 2011-2012.
Got it. I missed the legend over there, so thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. No, that is. And you can see last year's kind of the turquoise color, and you can see how much higher we were than the year before. So 15-16 was much higher than 14-15. And I'm sure that's what you heard Superintendent from High Desert talking about. Is that great?
So
great growth.
So I'm still trying to understand. So how do you know? So how do the families find out, or how do you find out about the number? You're going to do that? Okay.
That's my job.
I'll try not to get ahead anymore.
Okay. So, in preparation for the 2009 legislative session, the legislature requested ODE to calculate the cost of providing adequate EI and ECSE services to children and families. It was a really difficult task in that there are wide differences in special education needs in children, and the amount and types of services differ from child to child. The result of this task was the development of a framework of services in order to calculate the costs. So first what we did is we grouped the children according to their special education needs. We treated the infants and toddlers as one group, but we broke the kids and the preschoolers into three different groups as being those children with low need, and those would be kids that need mostly speech services, moderate need, and high need. Then we constructed service models designed to meet an adequate level of service in each grouping. So, for early intervention, we recommended one time a week early intervention service at the child's home or child care. This slide shows the percentage of children that actually achieve that level of service. So we have about 30% of the infants and toddlers in the state receive one time a week early intervention service. In early childhood special education, as I mentioned before, we group kids into the low, moderate, and high need. Low need kids, like the kids needing speech, require, or the recommended level of service is a one time a week special education service like speech therapy. Moderate need is 3 times a week or 12 hours a week of preschool, with a one-time-a-week preschool consultation from a special education teacher and a one-time-a-month family education service. High need is 15 hours a week preschool with a one-time-a-week preschool consultation from a specialist, like a teacher of the hearing impaired, teacher of the vision impaired, a physical therapist, and a one-time-a-week family education service. Close to 60% of the children in the low-need group receive that level, that recommended level of service. And you can see from the slide that the high-need group is the most likely to not receive the recommended level of service. About 3% of the kids in the high-need group do receive the recommended level.
Okay. Can I ask
okay. Representative Hack, yes, you might.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Why?
Can I show you in the next slides?
Okay. Thank you. Of course.
Okay. Funding of the recommended levels of service is around $10,000 per child. Currently, we're at approximately $7,900 per child. And I say that that's approximately because the amount per child changes every month when we get a new child count, because then we have a new amount of money. You know, we have to divide by a new number of kids to figure out what the amount per child might be. Teachers and specialists are the most costly part of our budget, and funding has not kept pace with the growing cost, which is illustrated in the next slide. So this slide shows, in the hot pink, is our actual funding, and in the bright blue is the gap between actual funding and adequate funding. And you can see that it has gone up. You mentioned Ways and Means giving us additional money. It has gone up, but to reach that adequate funding level is just continues to be out of reach.
But you still have the requirement to serve.
Yes, we have the requirement to serve every child who qualifies.
Can I
Representative Hack,
sure. Thank you, Chair Lively, and I don't mean to interrupt your where you're at.
No, that's fine.
So obviously, we've got to do a better job of funding these programs. So I'm going to mirror what Representative Hayden stressed there. But how do you determine then, if you don't have the adequate funding, how do you determine who gets it, who doesn't? Is there some sort of a formula that you say these kids get it, these kids don't? And if it is the case, our most needy seem to be getting the least. So how is that determined?
So all children get services. Every child who qualifies has to receive services. And honestly, what happens is the programs stretch their budget. If you have a child who's been receiving service, I'll go back to the kids in early intervention. And the recommended level of service is 1 time a week, service at home with parents. And what happens is we stretch, and right now the amount of service that those kids receive is about 1 time every 2 weeks. So we stretch and stretch to accommodate everyone.
Can I follow up?
No, go ahead.
So 1 time every 2 weeks, what would be adequate?
1 time a week. Every week.
So they're basically receiving half of what they actually should be receiving.
On average, yes.
Wow, disheartening. I mean, I don't want to come across like I'm not, that I think you're not doing a good job. Can I? Sorry, Chair. Because I know it's not, so please don't take it that way. It saddens me that we cannot make this more of a priority and that we don't choose to put more of our dollars here. So just makes me sad that we don't.
Representative Hayden.
A point on that, Chair Lively, thank you. It doesn't take twice as much money because you've already got the system there. It takes a little bit more money to get twice as much frequency. So I think that's important for us to understand. The little bit of money with the system that's already there, we can provide twice the frequency of that. I just think it's really important. So.
Thank you.
Great point.
Yes. Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. Again, I just want to echo the words of my colleagues over here, but also, do you have that number? What is that number?
Which number?
The number that you need to get once a week. You have your funding levels up there.
So it's going to be the difference between the $10,000 per child and $7,900 per child.
Slide 24.
Yep.
Gotcha. Sorry. Thank you.
so as we continue to improve our early childhood system, we will have improved screening and referral, and more children are going to be eligible for early intervention and early childhood services. The next two speakers are going to talk to you about the pathway from screening and referral to services in our program. Thank you very much.
Quick question. Back to the middle school. You don't have to go back, but
okay.
the picture of the middle school young lady.
Uh-huh.
Did she happen to be the one that testified at the roadshow hearing in Madras?
I don't know if she did or not, but
looks
Diane Tipton
worse.
Is here, and
Victoria.
She might know that. Her name's Victoria.
Was it the one?
Victoria Hansen.
Mm. She was cute. Did a great job. She read her script to all of us and everything. It was great.
Good. I hope you all don't mind if we go out of turn. My name is Monique Carroll, and I think I'm on your script as third, but it worked better if I went first.
Okay.
So Chair Lively and members of the Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee, my name is Monique Carroll. I'm a board certified pediatrician. I've practiced medicine in Oregon for the past 9 years, including 6 at the community health centers of Lane County. Prior to that, I served as a pediatrician in the Air Force for 7 years. I currently provide medical care for mainly OHP patients or the uninsured as a safety net provider. Our clinic population has high levels of poverty and family disruption. In my clinic, or in all pediatric clinics, pediatricians provide developmental surveillance at each visit. That means as part of our visit, you know, we identify things that are not within a typical range. We particularly do this at well-child checkups. And then per the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines, we're instructed to administer a standardized developmental screen at 9 months, 18 months, and 24 to 30 months. We use a standardized screening tool because we realized if we just looked at kids clinically, we miss approximately 70% of subtle developmental delays. So these may be like mild speech articulation delays that improve with speech therapy, but if the child doesn't talk to us in the clinic, we don't hear it. In Oregon, the Oregon Health Authority requirements follow the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines with a preference for a specific screening tool called the Ages and Stages Questionnaire, the ASQ. One of our CCO incentive metrics over the past 3 years has been annual developmental screenings for children under 3 years. So this falls in line with the AAP guidelines, 9 months, 18 months, 24 to 30 months. The use of the Ages and Stages Questionnaire is standard across the state, and so medical providers use the same screening questionnaire that early intervention uses, that community providers use, that daycare providers use. This allows for easily communicated information from the medical providers to the service providers to daycare, so that we're all speaking the same language. Once a developmental abnormality is identified, either through standardized screening or through routine surveillance, I am mandated by the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and federal guidelines to refer to early intervention within 7 days. Generally, this means that I fax a referral to my local early childhood intervention office, so EC Cares in Lane County. EC Cares helps coordinate what services are needed. If they need help, they're familiar with other referral sources in the area, like DHS. And then they also, once they've done their evaluation, they return feedback to me, and they're very diligent about this. The process is well understood by all the referral sources in the county, so there's little lag time in referrals or confusion. Services get done relatively quickly. Children who receive these therapies, you know, speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy in our county are more likely to graduate from high school, live independently, avoid teen pregnancy, delinquency, and violent crime. The CDC estimates that the long-term savings cost per referral is $30,000 per child. I estimate that I refer 35 children a year. Excuse me. And this can be a savings of $1 million a year for my population. At the CHC where I work, we track whether ASQs are performed. In 2014, 185 children were screened. In 2015, 201. In 2016, 277. And that's screened out of a denominator of about 500 children. So that's really only 50% of the children that are assigned to me by Medicaid that are getting screened. I estimate that about 20% of our population gets referred. For 2017, our CCO benchmark is to screen 60% of the population, and so these numbers are going to continue to rise as we do the right thing for our population. Accordingly, I expect the need for services to increase as well. In turn, this will result in improved lives and decreased long-term costs for our population. So thank you for the opportunity to speak on this.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Representative Hatton.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for your heart, for the work that you do. When you said that like 50% are actually screened, is that because of manpower to do the screenings, or is that for other reasons?
You know, a lot of times it is just getting children in for routine checkups at the right time. So that is one of our other CCO directives over the next few years, is getting childhood immunizations and having routine well child care before the age of three. The AAP mandates or wants us to see children 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 15 months, 18 months, 2 years, two and a half, and three. So 10 times in the first 3 years. For my Medicaid population, it's often a lot less than that. And so these are kids that are assigned to me, but maybe I've never seen them. Mm-hmm. So.
Representative Bynum and then Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your work. I'm sitting here thinking we're spending $10,000 a year for a public school student. And so my question is, once the children get enrolled into school, I'm sure there's an additional, I don't know, X amount of thousands of dollars we're spending to make sure that the children are cared for. But can you talk about root causes for children being born with special needs? And are there things, I know we have nurse home visits for interventions for healthy births, but are there some root causes that we should be looking at to prevent the additional, I don't want to say a child ever is a burden on the system, but to prevent even having to add additional services for a child?
So I think, you know, a lot of these are social determinants, you know, of health. So if a family doesn't have housing and they move frequently, if they don't have social supports, and so children don't hear the thousands of words they need to hear in their early lifetime, if they don't have access to quality child care or family parenting services where parents, young parents, or any parents learn to read to their children, learn to identify that their children's having problems speaking or that they're not keeping up with their peers so they can access service earlier. A lot of these children who get, you know, especially in the low-risk group, if they get speech therapy or they get physical therapy or they get some of the social behavioral supports and their parents get parenting supports, they don't end up needing ongoing care in elementary school and middle school. But the longer you let it go, the more it costs in the long term.
So, Chair, can I have one
thought? Sure, go ahead.
So are you suggesting that most or many of the kids, their challenges could be prevented?
Only my opinion, of course. But, yes, I think a lot of these can be prevented if we have appropriate parenting support. So if we had more access for home visiting nurses who can support families early on, if we lots of young children don't get to go to preschool and don't get the school readiness. And, you know, we work on that through, like, Kids in Transition Services and Preschool Promise. But there's still a large amount of children who just don't get that readiness to get to school.
Can I add to that?
Sure.
I think.
Would you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. My name's Judy Newman, and I'm testifying next. I'm the co-director of Early Childhood Cares. I just wanted to respond because one thing about early intervention, early childhood special education, there are no income requirements. We serve all kids across all income levels. And disability is pretty well documented in the United States for many, many years that you will have about 10% of your population. And so some of the kids we see, it is social determinants. But many of the kids, really, they have genetic disorders. Autism is not due to social variants. I mean, a good percentage percentage of our kids, and I know in my region I track very closely the kids that go to kindergarten and don't need services anymore, which I think would fall a lot into that category, and it never really, it's about 25%. So 75% of the kids still legitimately need some kind of special education. So it's important to know we could do better with some of our kids, but income isn't the requirement, and that only represents a portion of them. So I just wanted to leave that as
Representative Malmstrom and then Representative.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Sure. I have a question. going back to your needing improved screening and referral, the ASQs, I'm very familiar with the ASQs. I've done a zillion of them in the past. There is a difference between, even though it's written for the parent to self-do, mm-hmm. having done nurse visits side-by-side with the parents, I often will dig a lot deeper and get a better assessment. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at this, how many of these are done totally by parent report without any sort of assistance, and how many have come, you know, with a little more meat to them?
In my clinic, so this is always a problem because they take time. You know, so they take 10 or 15 minutes, and if you send them to their homes, often you don't get them back, or if you send them home with you, you don't get them back. In my clinic, it's mostly parent done. It's done at the visit, and so if they can't read, if they speak a different language, we have Spanish, but if they need assistance, we help. But the reality is we don't have, in the past, we used to have nurses that would do, you know, the screens in clinic, and healthcare doesn't pay for that anymore.
Right. I'm very aware of
that.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, it's an important thing if you want to get more accurate assessment and referral.
And I think really the point is that even that is better than what we thought we were doing in the past. We thought we were doing a great job, and it turns out we missed lots of things, lots of subtle things.
So, Chair Lively and Representative Malmstrom, I think I'm going to cover a little bit, because we actually also follow up on screenings when we get a referral to try to mitigate some of that as well. So that's a great question.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Mine, I guess, is a little bit of a statement in regards to your comment about the fact that 75% actually continue to need services in schools, yet I think what's really disheartening is that we only reimburse schools up to 11% of their population. So if there's a school that's great at servicing special needs kids, it doesn't matter. If they have more than 11% of their population, they only get reimbursed those additional dollars, Representative Bynum, that you're referencing, up to 11%. And it's an absolute disservice to our school districts and to our kids that need those special services, because we don't fully fund that.
Yeah.
And it's disheartening.
Representative Kindergarten.
Thank you. And can I ask a question about that? Because I remember the 11%, but I know that we made a change in the last budget that we did. And I don't know if we expanded it to 11% because it was even less, or we said after 11%, you get a partial payment for some other percentage. Woke something up in my mind. I can't remember what it went from and to.
There used to be a way.
You know, I think that I probably need to take that question back and get the real answer. I kind of want to answer it right now, and I know I shouldn't.
Thank you. You would
get
the information.
And I wanted to also just clarify, 75% of the kids that are eligible for early childhood special ed go on to need services. It's not 75% of the kids in school. So in general, okay, great. You got it. Thank you.
But there's still many, many, many that need services.
You're absolutely right. Most of our school districts have more than 11% of kids in special ed. Yeah.
Okay. So before Judy Newman presents, I just, full disclosure here. So one of the reasons I'm sitting here and doing this work is because of Judy. Her and I have been involved for I don't know how many years. Started with Success by Six and a whole bunch of things in our community, and she does tremendous work. But she helped educate me with all these issues in that, so I could fully understand and be it. So I'm glad she's here.
Thank you. So my turn?
Yeah.
Chair Lively and members of the Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee. My name's Judy Newman, and I, as I said earlier, I'm the co-director, co-founder of Early Childhood Cares, which is the one university-affiliated early intervention, early childhood special ed program. I'm also very involved in our Early Learning Hub, by the way, and on the State Interagency Coordinating Council. So I bring like a little bit broader view to the early childhood arena here. I'm going to talk about how kids get into our program. So every early intervention and early childhood special education program, thank you, is charged with the responsibility of finding all birth to five-year-old children in their service area who qualify for services. It's our job to go out there looking. So in order to do this, we reach out to natural touch points for young children, where parents go, where the kids are found. So we go to places, we go to people, we go to the social media where our parents would be looking, and we tell them about our services. So in early childhood cares, we get approximately 145 referrals every month, which is, you know, somewhere between 1,700 and 1,800 referrals a year. The most common referral sources you see listed up there, these are the largest numbers. Parents themselves refer to us, physicians, usually pediatricians or family practice docs, child care and preschool providers, Head Start, Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Early Head Start, Department of Human Services, Child Welfare, Relief Nurseries, Public Health Programs, Preschool Promise, and then other local programs. About 5 years ago, the CCOs, as Dr. Carroll said, implemented an incentive metric for physicians to do a developmental screening on every child before their third birthday. And this has resulted in an increase in percentage of children screened every year. As the number of children screened has increased, the rate of referrals for EI-ECSE has also really risen dramatically. Just to give you an example, just last year in my program, from December to December, we increased by 10%. That's a huge increase. Similar increases are being experienced across the state in both the percent of kids screened and the increased referrals to EI-ECSE programs, and we anticipate these rates going up. As Dr. Carroll mentioned, we're only at 50% statewide. Now, this is really fantastic news from our perspective. It means that children who need help are being identified earlier and linked to services that will provide help at the most critical period in their lives, and their brain development, as you know, is the most rapid in this period. Therefore, it is critical that services be supported to keep pace with the increased demand. So, you might wonder, and I heard the question from the group, what happens to a referral once it's made to an EI-ECSE program? So I'm going to just walk you through an example for our program, what happens at Early Childhood Cares. So, Dr. Carroll here faxes in a referral to Early Childhood Cares for Trevor, a 10-month-old boy that she saw that day at a well baby visit. In addition to the contact information, she faxed in a developmental screening questionnaire that was completed by the mother and reviewed by Dr. Carroll at the visit. Now, the screening indicated that Trevor was experiencing possible delays in all areas of his development. That would be gross and fine motor, communication, social-emotional, cognitive, self-care, and problem and adaptive. So a professional at EC Cares with an expertise in development reviewed the screening for completeness and accuracy and then calls the family to ask any follow-up questions, including basic information about the child's health, hearing, and vision status, and some probing questions to get at the accuracy. While she's on the phone, if it looks like a really good screening with mom, she schedules, our screener schedules a convenient time for an in-depth developmental assessment to take place in Trevor's home. She was given basic information, the mom, about what to expect on the visit and was encouraged to ask any questions that she had. And the majority, just so you know, the majority of our initial evaluations are done either in the child's home or at their child care site, and we like this for a couple reasons. The child's most comfortable there, the parent's usually most comfortable there, so we get a really true picture. And also, it's easier for families. They have siblings, and many of them have challenges with transportation. So a team of two professionals went to Trevor's home. In Trevor's case, it was an early EIECSE specialist and a speech and language therapist. They began by explaining to the parent about early childhood cares and the purpose of the assessment, what tools they'd be using, and getting them to ask any questions they might have or concerns. This initial conversation actually provides the chance for the child to warm up a little bit to the people that are in their home, and also for the parents to feel comfortable about what's about going to happen. Now, if you observe an assessment, on the surface it looks like a fun playtime. But the assessments that we use are, in fact, carefully designed to get standardized and accurate information about the child's development. So the assessment results were shared with Trevor's parents at the home visit. Trevor was found to be eligible for early intervention under the developmental delay category. And the next step was to develop a plan for Trevor called an IFSP, Individualized Family Service Plan. And this is always done as a team between the professionals and the parents. And they identify Trevor's strengths, what he needs to learn, what services he'll receive, and what the families need to actually support Trevor's development themselves. It was decided that Trevor received services in his home to address his goals and the family needs and priorities. So we started with weekly home visits for the first couple months, but because of caseloads, we had to then reduce it to biweekly home visits. So this entire process from assessment to eligibility to IFSP took about 90 minutes in the home with the family. Our staff is very efficient and works through these things. And then services begin, which is really what we all are looking for. So timelines to accomplish all of this that I talked about, from the referral to services, from the referral to our program all the way to when a child begins to get services, are governed and monitored by state and federal regulations, and they're really fast timelines, and they're very strict timelines. For the youngest children, we have 45 calendar days from the time the child is referred to our program till they start getting services to do all of this. And then for preschool-age children, we have 60 school days to actually complete the process. This ensures that children receive services they need as soon as possible. It's a very good requirement, and so we don't want to miss out on any of the critical weeks or months or years that we could really help influence this child's brain development. So remember, EIECSE can't have a wait list. All children identified must be served within this timeline. So we thank you a lot for your time and attention.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for this panel?
Hopefully that gives you more of a picture.
Representative Bynum, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a good handoff for military families when they're moving around and if they're accessing health care outside of a base? And I have no knowledge of how military families access.
Well, Chair Lively, Representative Bynum, probably the two of us could answer this. I actually had a niece who was born or adopted, actually, and her dad was in the military and received early intervention services. So the military often provides the services themselves.
It depends on the area and depends on what type of base. So if it's a smaller base that uses local medical school services, it's the same process. So when I was in the military, I would refer to the local early intervention service area, and they would provide services. If you're overseas or in a place where the school may be part of the base, they have their own process of doing that. And then if children are identified with disabilities, they actually travel with paperwork that identifies their needs, yeah. So that their service member can only be transferred to places where they can get those services.
And that gets transferred, and there are actually federal guidelines about how fast you have to actually serve kids. Within the state, it's almost seamless because we're all in the same database. We have a great database. So all my program is, someone moves from Portland to Eugene, I just go on the database, and we can immediately pick up services without almost missing any time. If they move from a different state, I think we're given, you know, within a couple weeks to be able to access those records.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Lively. great program. And my understanding is that this is in the regular school districts. It's also available in the charter schools, that you engage with the charter schools. But if a child is in private education, not in the school system, if you will, how do you engage with those students or potential clients, or do you?
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden. We do, but it's a little bit different for preschool because we don't have charter schools in preschool, but we do have private community preschools. And so very often it's different because that's where our children are. So either we go into those private preschools and serve kids because that is their school setting. And sometimes we contract with those preschools to actually pay the tuition for kids if they need it and their parents couldn't pay. And then provide services. So it's different than school age because we don't have a public education program for every child under age 5. Does that answer your...
Well, I'm just wondering how you get those contacts. How do the parents find you? Mm-hmm. How do the parents find out about the program if they're not in...
Representative Lively, Representative Hayden... all of our programs are required to do something that we call child find, and that is to find all of the kids who may qualify for our program. And so they would work with all of those private preschools, community preschools, to have referral systems set up that they can refer to our program. Also through the early childhood system and the increase in screening and using the ASQ is that all of those community preschools are receiving some training around how to do that kind of screening and work with parents to identify kids and refer.
Thank you.
Did you want to add?
Yeah, so for example, you saw the referral sources. The third biggest was from child care providers. We partner with the child care resource and referral. So when I said we go to natural touch points, we put ads in their newspapers. We give them things they can give to parents, you know, in their newsletters so everyone knows about it. We teach classes and have open times for preschool providers to come to. So a lot of community outreach.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
You bet. So the next panel, we have Lisa and Diane. Good coordination that you have one presentation and you're all continuing to follow through.
Just keep
good
going.
Good
so,
job.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Lively and members of the committee, for giving us the opportunity to present today. So I'm going to try this clicker here. I think. Oh. Keep going. Here I am. Okay. So I am the program director for Multnomah Early Childhood Program, Lisa Grotting, and our agency.
Would you introduce your name for
again?
The record,
okay. I am Lisa Grotting, the director of Multnomah Early Childhood Program.
Thank you.
Our agency provides services to children birth to age 5 throughout Multnomah County, which encompasses 8 school districts. Currently, we serve 2,600 children with disabilities. 35% of the children receive early intervention, which are children from birth to age 3. 65% of the children are age 3 to age 5, which is early childhood special education. MECP employs highly qualified staff to serve children and families. All of our teachers and most of our related staff have master level degrees. In order to meet the diverse cultural needs of the families MECP serve, we provide interpreters who go into the homes with our providers. We also employ a Latino community health worker who works with families in need of assistance in navigating the medical and educational needs of their child and family. At MECP, we strive hard to hire bicultural and bilingual staff. In the MECP model, we have one professional is considered the primary service provider who can utilize other related staff for the purpose of consultation, and this helps us in eliminating the duplication of services. Early intervention services are provided in child cares, early Head Start classrooms, but mostly in the home. The home is what we consider the natural environment. We closely coordinate with the home visiting system in Multnomah County so that there's not duplication of services. In early intervention, the service provider coaches and models interventions for the parent. The best investment we have is in parents. Who knows their child better than a parent? No one. The parent spends more time with their child than anyone else. When the service provider works with the parent and child, this allows for continuous intervention when the service provider is not present in the home. Did I get it? There we go. Let me see. Research confirms that providing services in the home is best practice because parents know what works best for their family, and the opportunities for learning occur during their child's daily routines, such as eating, dressing, toileting, bedtime. Children learn through these repeated interactions, and research also tells us that providing services in the home lessens the stress on families' lives. Next, I would like to give you an example of how services are provided for children in early intervention, which is the birth to three. This is an example of a speech and language pathologist, which we call SLP, going into the home. The SLP talks with the family about success and challenges of the week. The SLP and the parent work as a team. They use toys and items that are in the home to facilitate language development. So we don't bring in toy bags. We use what's in the home. So it's always left there that way. The SLP models what the play-based intervention looks like. The parent then models back the intervention, and the parent and child repeat this activity and other activities until the SLP has a visit the following week. Next, I want to talk about ECSE, and as I said before, ECSE services are for students with disabilities from age 3 until they go to kindergarten at the age of 5. The services are provided in many different community settings and with many different partners. Although we provide a high percentage of services in the home, when the child is ready, we help families connect with other children for social opportunities and community settings where they can continue to learn and play with typically developing children, many of whom that they will all attend kindergarten with. Are we behind? Let's see. In ECSE, my program continues to follow the model of one professional serving the child in any of these settings, with collaborative consultative support from other MECP professionals. Collaborative support from other professionals ensures all the child's goals are addressed with instructional modifications and adaptations so that the child can be successful in a preschool setting. All services are individualized for every child and family needs. Here I have an example. I don't know if you can see it here. This is an example of a modification. This is a social visual for a child who has difficulties in communicating and engaging in play. So we would help the child with a visual showing pick a friend, go over here to the center that has blocks. Here's some things that you can make, a bridge, a tower, a road. You're going to play with your friend and build together. So this is one of the modifications that we would use in a preschool setting. This is an example of, this is a real example of a 4-year-old child with an autism eligibility who is receiving services in a Head Start. This child has many complicated needs and goals with the goals in the areas of sensory, communication, social skills, and has behaviors that impede on his ability to interact with others. The ECSE teacher interacts with all the students, including the student with autism. We don't pull children away from what they are already involved in. In the dramatic play area, the ECSE teacher would demonstrate different play schemes while encouraging all students to use positive behavior friendship skills. Research tells us that positive peer modeling increases appropriate social skills. While interacting with all the students, the ECSE teacher models play and social skills for the preschool staff. During the monthly collaboration meeting, which is once a month, we hold that with the preschool staff. The ECSE teacher discusses with the preschool staff about what they observed and what they can do to continue the positive social interactions for all children. The ECSE teacher continues to consult with the MECP related staff to support this child's developmental goals. The entire team works together to support this child's success in a preschool environment. Many children who receive services may not need services once they enter kindergarten. If they continue to need special education, our service providers work with families and the homeschool transition team for a smooth handoff to the school-age team. Parents will be with their children throughout their lifetime, and early intervention and early childhood special education services support children and parents until their child goes to kindergarten and then finishes their educational journey.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chairman Lively and members of the committee. My name is Diane Tipton, and I am from Region 2. That was the yellow in the middle of the map. So I'm in Central Oregon area. And let me get to mine. So I'm to talk to you about outcomes of the program. As we, Lisa said, we have our specialists and teachers are highly qualified. Our teachers all hold the same teacher licenses as the K-12 teachers. Our specialists also have the professional board licenses that would allow them to work in a medical setting. We have the ability to bridge educational and medical needs for these children right at that critical time of brain development. 90% of the brain is developed during the period of time they're with us. The reason I put up quality of instruction, and this is the outcomes portion, is it's well documented that the number one indicator for student success later is that quality of teacher. We know we have accountability for teacher effectiveness through Senate Bill 290, and that was the recognition from Oregon realizing that we must have quality instruction because it's paramount for student success. So now I want to tell you about one of the students in our program. This is Elias. He started with us when he was 2.5 years old. He's now 4.5 years old. He would be considered a high-need student. He is severely impacted by his autism. He is nonverbal and had not uttered a word in the 2 years that we were serving him until last month. Last month, his mother shared that he had an interest in the dry erase board. As she was writing, he became interested in writing. She shared this with the teacher, and the next day the teacher pulled out a dry erase board and wrote, "Hi, Elias." And he took her face in his hands and said, "Hi," for his first time. Mm-hmm. Our program is data-driven. We have annual goals written on what's called the Individual Family Service Plan. It's much like the what you've heard of an IEP, an individual education plan that happens in K-12. So each child has their own individual goals that that pertain to that individual. Data is collected. We have a database, and each specialist or teacher working with that child inputs that data so that the whole team can see what's working for that child and what strategies might work, what strategies may not work with that child. So we're constantly monitoring how the child is doing on that plan. Statewide outcome data, Nancy shared some about that. We have that curriculum-based assessment that all of us throughout the state of Oregon use to look at all areas of development. So there's the individual family service plan, but there's also this other curriculum-based assessment that is continually monitored with each child. One of those areas is social-emotional skills that Nancy talked about. And in the 15-16 school year, 76%, this is the statewide data, of our 3 to 5-year-olds made substantial progress in the area of social-emotional skills. And 60% of these children statewide were functioning within the level of their typical peers. Kindergarten teachers across the state continue to relay to us preschool teachers and specialists that they prefer children to be ready in this area of social-emotional skills more than any other area. And an example of social-emotional skills might be the ability to calm yourself down when you're walking towards that red truck at free play and somebody else takes it right before you. So the ability to calm yourself, the ability to attend to a teacher during circle, these are the skills that are foundational for further learning. And it is currently our key performance measure for the state, also for both early intervention and early childhood special ed, under the direction of Nancy Johnson Dorn, for us to improve these skills. Return on investments. It's well documented in the literature that for every dollar you spend in early learning, you'll save $7 or $8 later on. Actually, those estimates are much higher when you include learning, early learning in the area of special education. So to realize the 40-40-20 goal, we need to start with getting students ready for kindergarten. And I wanted to give you some examples of the investment. Each year, statewide, between 20 and 25% of those 3 to 5-year-olds qualify in the area of articulation only, that's speech. Articulation errors are correlated with the sound errors when learning to read. So my two biggest school districts are the Ben Lapine School District and Redmond School District. And I took all of the what we call the SSID numbers, it's their unique identifiers, and I had data teams in 2012 see how did the kids do that had speech services for articulation only, how did they fare on their third grade benchmark tests. And the results were 100% in Redmond and 93% in Bend met or exceeded their benchmark tests in the area of language. So that our main goal is to get children ready for kindergarten. In the last 4 school years in Lane County, almost 25% of all early childhood special education students did not need special education services when they entered kindergarten. Judy touched on that, you know, so what about that 75%? There are children that are going to probably continue to need special education through their K-12 academic career. However, services will probably be lessened significantly by the fact that they first started with us. So not only is it a great economic investment to invest in this program early, it changes the lives of each one of those children that are able to go through their career and not need special education services later or have a lot less need. So I wanted to thank you for your support. Are there
thank
any questions?
Thank you very much. Questions?
Just a comment. Both these panels were fantastic. It's very made a very clear case. I have a minor question for Lisa Grotting. Are you related to Don?
I am. That's my husband.
Well, that was a big loss to the David Douglas School District. We're glad to still have you out there.
Thank
and
you.
I know he shares your passion on early childhood because I worked with him on the Earl of Boyle's.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, you're a powerful pair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. No, this has been great. So we have one more panel. Danielle, Cassandra, and Sarah.
Is there an order?
Oh, it's you?
Yeah, so you're first.
Thank you, Chair Lively.
Thank you.
Committee. My name is Sarah Brentano Woodley. I am the mother of a beautiful, brilliantly blue-eyed 6-year-old named Caroline who experiences Creedy-Shaw syndrome and autism spectrum disorder. I'm here to tell you a little bit about our experience with early childhood special ed. My sweet Caroline has a mountain of obstacles that she has to overcome daily, from sleep apnea and low muscle tone, sensory difficulties, mobility constraints. She's fed through a G-tube in her stomach for nutrition. She's nonverbal. She's in that ODE high need category, the one where less than 3% of those kids receive the necessary service level. So from age 3 to 5, Caroline was bused over 30 minutes from our home to a Willamette ESD specialized preschool in Salem, where she received only 5.5 hours of schooling per week. Last year, we moved her to the Almsville specialized preschool closer to our home, which was wonderful. But still, with her limited service levels, her IFSP goals were going unmet. And they were repeating year after year after year. New skills weren't being learned. She was regressing in areas. She was denied access to typical peers and being set up for failure in future classrooms. So in November of 2015, I requested that Caroline's services be immediately brought to the standard level set forth by the ODE, and I was denied. I believe that Caroline deserves the same educational opportunities as any of her peers, and she wasn't getting it. So I also requested that tuition be paid at a typical preschool during the days and times that she wasn't attending that specialized preschool. And to that we received a yes. On Wednesday, February 17th, 2016, almost 1 year ago today, Caroline went to her first day at Fruitland Elementary School in Salem. She got to go there 3 days a week, which tripled her service level from what she was previously receiving. On the first day at Fruitland, she began using a walker for the first time to access peers and activities. She touched Play-Doh for the first time, which is a big deal because she couldn't even be in the same room with it. She took turns with peers who she was never interested in before. She used her speech-generating device to request food and preferred items. And her teacher just kept saying, well, hasn't she always done that? No, she had not. I have a quick video clip of her first day home after school when she used her walker for the first time in our home. So I just want to show you that. Awesome. That was the very first time I set that walker out in the living room, and she grabbed it and just started heading down the hallway, and I was excited and bawling at the same time. So in the 3 months of increased service level, Caroline blossomed and her life completely changed. We saw a dramatic increase in her skills. She's going over 40 feet in her walker. She had increased general stamina. She was using her Dynavox for effective communication. She was engaging with peers and accomplishing tasks that I never imagined that she could do. And now this year, she's in general ed kindergarten in our home school of Sublimity Elementary. She's taking independent steps without her walker. She's sitting at the table and having snacks with her peers. She's participating in circle time and working on colors and letters and numbers, signing and verbalizing so much that she doesn't even have to use that Dynavox anymore. And yesterday, I received this email from her teacher. The kinders were playing tag games in PE, and Caroline just jumped right in and followed directions best she could. She used her walker and played tag with the kids. She has made lots of growth in joining in the fun, and she had the best PE day ever. Our sweet Caroline will accomplish amazing things in her life that will positively and dramatically impact others, and her educational experience finally supports this. But the road wasn't easy, and I'm continually having to advocate for her rights. Children with the highest level of need receive the least amount of support and yet are held to the highest standard. This failure to provide a free and appropriate public education to our state's youngest and most vulnerable citizens needs to end. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next.
Okay. Chair Lively and members of the committee. My name is Cassandra Trout from Springfield. I'm here today because of my son, Ben, who was born with a very rare genetic disorder. He's now 6, but our family began working with early intervention when he was only 2 months old. Our service providers worked with us each year to identify his current needs. which have always been significant, and ensure that we knew the best strategies and techniques to help him meet those needs. His early intervention team was the foundation of our family's support system and had a profound impact on his development. He finally learned to walk when he was 3, and although he still cannot speak, he is responding to his name and interacting with us more. So we have all heard that the parent is the child's first and best teacher. But if you put yourself in my family's shoes for a minute, children learn so much by listening to us and watching us and interacting with us. But what if your child can't hear you because he has a hearing loss and isn't watching you because he's more interested in his hands than anything you have to say, and doesn't even want to make eye contact with you, let alone interact with you? What do you do? How do you teach this child? Our family began to lose hope. But early intervention and early childhood special education help rebuild hope by giving families the tools they need to help their children succeed. Our specialists made a difference for Ben, not because of the limited amount of time they had with him, but because of what they taught my husband and me. In Oregon, of the children with the most significant needs, like Ben, less than 3% are actually receiving the service levels recommended by research and best practices. Many families receiving early intervention only have 1 hour every 2 weeks with a specialist. Funding has not kept pace with new children being identified for services, and service levels have decreased substantially. Our service levels decreased during our time. Evidence shows that if we invest in these children now when they are young, we save so much when they go to formal schooling. I am currently a special education teacher for kindergarten through second grade, and I work with a lot of these kids who haven't had enough of this early support. They are frustrated, confused, and overwhelmed by our primary learning system. My son is in kindergarten now, and he is frequently overwhelmed because at 6 years old, he still doesn't have a functional communication system. He still cannot communicate his needs or wants to anyone, and he doesn't even understand basic directions like follow me or wait. Our ECSD program was great. I loved everyone, but unfortunately, he needed more. Oregon has invested in early intervention and early childhood special education in order to change the lives of families like ours. So we need to actually invest enough to be able to provide the service levels that have proven to be effective in making those changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Cassandra.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and members of the committee. Most of you here may know me from Children's Institute. I work there as a director of communications, but I'm here today as a parent. My son, Lee, is now 9 years old, and I think his picture may be on...
excuse me.
I'm sorry?
Your name for the record?
Danielle Pacifico Cogan, PACIFICO-COGAN.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm here today in my capacity as a parent and not as a professional child advocate. So so that's why I'm here. But listening to the other two ladies, I'm getting a little emotional because we share a lot of a similar story. But my son is now 9 years old. His name is Lee, and he was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder about a week before his 3rd birthday. And up until that time, he did exhibit some, you know, unique behaviors like lining up cars, but we didn't really understand what those behaviors meant. And 6 months before his 3rd birthday, we went on a family trip to Italy in which he learned how to speak Italian within 3 days because he was raised to be bilingual in Spanish and English. My husband spoke to him primarily in English, and I spoke to him primarily in Spanish. So when you come home with a kid who can speak Italian and Spanish and English but doesn't look you in the eyes and runs away and doesn't and acts like he doesn't hear you, you start to wonder what's going on. So our son was diagnosed a week before his 3rd birthday, and we left the doctor's office being told that Portland Public Schools would contact us to find out if we could get an educational diagnosis. And that is the only information that we left the pediatrician with. Nobody told us anything about autism. We had no idea. So we had to seek out the information for ourselves. And then we became very lucky because we were able to go to an early childhood special education preschool operated by a teacher named Molly Banks at Grout School in Southeast Portland. And Molly Banks was a veteran teacher who had two or three veteran assistants with her. And they were able to help my son and his classmates of various disabilities engage in learning that allowed them to learn pre-academic skills like number recognition and letter recognition, which is essential, obviously, for kindergarten readiness. But more importantly, they learned teamwork skills, and they learned attentiveness skills, and they learned to work together, which is also helpful for kindergarten, but more importantly, is helpful for life. And it helps them to engage with their peers. And while we loved ECSE services at the preschool, my husband and I also spent out of pocket every month for 2 years, $1,500 a month to send him to applied behavioral analysis therapy. And there are families who need that therapy as well, but are not able to afford that therapy. So we recognize that we are very fortunate, and we've been completely fortunate in our whole journey. And not fortunate only in having education and ability to advocate for him, but fortunate as well because we did not heed the advice of what one disability advocate said to us, or so-called advocate, that you must mourn the child that you thought you had. Mm-hmm. And I think that is highly offensive for many reasons, but the child that he was and the child he is the child that he was born as glorious and as challenging and as loving and as infuriating as it can be to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning with somebody jumping up and down with forks in his hand. He is that person. And we love him for who he is, and we will always love him. But I do recognize that in the luck that we've had and in meeting other parents in waiting room offices, you know, when you're waiting for the pediatrician or the special needs dentist or the behavioral therapist or the occupational therapist, you run into a lot of different families. And my husband and I have taken it upon ourselves to say, hey, what's going on? Do you need help with things? Because we recognize that we're able to navigate the system a lot better than some other people because of our education and because of we have a little bit of other resources. But then we also recognize that education should not be a barrier to be able to advocate for your child. And there are people who don't have a college education who are better advocates for their children than we are because they're passionate and they'll do whatever it takes for it to happen. But education and money should not determine whether or not your child receives the best services available. And finally, I would like to note two things that I would ask as a parent, not as a representative of any organization for which I'm paid, but I ask that that we preserve and protect early childhood special education and early intervention because these programs are essential. They change children's lives and they give children the opportunity to live full and productive lives. And when I say full and productive lives, I don't mean that, you know, maybe one day they will be able to speak because some kids may never be able to speak, but that should not hinder them from having the opportunity. As an educational theorist once said, genius is universal, but the opportunity to express your genius is not. And we should not allow children in Oregon to fall into that fate of not being able to express their genius. And secondly, I would ask, as a parent as well, that if it's possible for DHS or DDS to look into the way that it shares information with parents. Because I think a lot of times once you get a diagnosis and somebody says to you, oh, then just go to the state of Oregon's website and figure it out. It's almost impossible to figure out what your next step is after a medical or educational diagnosis and what you do next and how you access services. So I just ask for a streamlining, not necessarily streamlining, but a simple for face family forward way for people to be able to access the information so that it's useful. And I thank you for this time and allowing me to speak.
Thank you very much. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair Lively. I just wanted to say thank you for all of you being champions. I have a nephew that is severely autistic and is non-audible, so this is very near and dear to me and have watched our family navigate. And we, too, were told to mourn him, very similar to that. And it's tragic because they are extremely special and wonderful in their own way. My question would be, and Daniel, you touched a little bit on this, if there is something that you could tell this committee or ask of us to consider doing or changing, this is a journey that a lot of people cannot even begin to understand or wrap their heads around, what would it be that you would tell us that you would have
like to have seen done differently or something, what would be your wish list? What would be in the bucket of, I mean, Danielle touched on a couple of things, the DHS navigation, and then some of those barriers in education. What about the two of you? And I think, is your dad Sam?
Yes.
Yeah. I sent Sam a picture of you, by the way. Oh, her dad is wonderful. A commissioner, county commissioner, who has dedicated many, many years of his life to public service and is just a wonderful man.
When Caroline started her preschool journey, I was thrilled that there was some place who would take her for 5 hours a week. I was at that place, and parents aren't given information. I've spent the last 6 years working with family networks and OD and joining the SICC, State Interagency Coordinating Council, just trying to gain as much information as I could about what was out there and where was I supposed to go and what was possible for Caroline. So I've gone from that parent who was just thrilled someone would take her for 5 hours to demanding that she receive the same education and the opportunities as everybody else. But as you were saying, most parents don't realize that that's even a possibility. I see Caroline walking across the stage at high school graduation now, and in the beginning I didn't, and I wasn't given any of those resources. So people with time constraints, language barriers, any of those things, they're not going to be able to advocate for their kids. Most kids do not get that opportunity to go to the public preschool like Caroline got. We had to work really hard for that opportunity, and it's just a shame. We need the money. We need the money. There's just nothing else to say besides we need more money.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Lively. We talk about the needs in the future, but I think it's also appropriate to look back in the past, and at least in Lane County, my interaction with these types of programs. I think there's been tremendous leadership in these programs with limited funds to move them forward, mm-hmm. to make people aware. And so we're not there yet, but I think we do need credit to all the folks that have really worked hard over the last 10, 15, 20 plus years to bring these programs to light and recognize that, you know, it's those folks that are on the ground pushing this forward all the time, and they're just as important or more important than the dollar figure attached to it.
Absolutely.
So, Cassandra, did you want to respond to what Representative Hack asked before we move on?
Yes, and it's a little bit in response to what you were saying as well, Representative Hayden. Just that, you know, I had the opportunity last year to actually work for Early Childhood Cares with Judy, and, you know, there is that system in place, that child find system, to be able to, you know, connect with the community and try to get information out to parents. But unfortunately, because of the limited funding that early intervention and early childhood special education has, really the bulk of those resources go to the services we can provide. And so, you know, I know for many parents, it's very, and I'm sure you guys can attest this, at least in the beginning, it's very isolating, because you don't know who you can talk to about these things. And so really, for that first year, my main source of information was my service provider for that first year. I didn't have any friends going through this. I didn't have any connections at that time. And so, I mean, only seeing them twice a month, it was like every time they walked in the door, I had like 50 questions. And so, you know, really having the opportunity to be able to provide that service level, I think is going to be a huge help to families, because they have more opportunities to interact with people who do have those connections to those resources in the community. Because I know our coordinator always had different strategies and different ideas of how to get out in the community. They have different resources they can help pull for you. And so I just think that that's really important that we have the funding to be able to do that, in addition to giving families the services that they need.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you to all of you moms. And whenever I think I might get tired, I'll think of you and keep pushing. So my first question is about getting tired, and if there are any services that allow you some level of relief. So like we have the relief nurseries. Are families able to access those for children with special needs, or is there any are there any services in that realm? And then my second question is, what was the role of insurance in helping you access services that your children needed? And our insurance providers helping where they need to or where you think they should.
Okay. As far as the insurance providers, early intervention, early childhood, and special education, completely separate from insurance providers. I actually felt like going through insurance was more frustrating trying to get additional services. And so I actually, in the beginning, just shied away from it. It was overwhelming. I didn't want to deal with it. And so really, you know, since it was actually really nice that it was separate and we didn't have to worry about that. As far as supports and getting tired and overwhelmed, what's nice about the beginning with early intervention, because the child is so young, it's nice that they come in the home. But what's great about early childhood special education, like Sarah was saying, is, you know, somebody is willing to take them for a little bit, and you really do kind of get for a couple hours. Like, I think you had 5 hours a week to start. I think we started at 8 or something like that. It starts to give you a little bit of that respite. It's a nice mix. In the beginning, it's nice to have somebody coming to your home so you don't have to get them out of the house. And after you've been established for a while, after they're a little bit older, it's nice that they get to go be with some of their peers and out in the community.
I would just also add for us that respite care has not necessarily been the right fit, simply because our son is a bolter, so, yeah, and he can unlock any lock anywhere, so that's a lot of fun. So he's a bolter, and he doesn't, I think about 4 nights a week, he gets up at 2 in the morning and doesn't go back to sleep until about 5 in the morning, so my husband and I just trade off every night, so not a lot of rest. But in terms of the insurance issue, our insurance company was essentially forced to pay because of the implementation of ACA. So yes. Plug for ACA. And in terms of another issue I think it's very important to mention is these issues are exacerbated in rural areas where you don't have the same amount of workforce for early education teachers, you don't have the same number of therapists, and then you have issues of transportation and then even basic medical services. So imagine everything that we're talking about, and then you add the Wallawas to that. You add Baker City to that. You add Nyalkala to that. So, you know, I think these are really just important issues to bring up.
Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And I was actually going to say two things that were very similar to Rep. Bynum. First of all, again, what a fabulous panel to put faces and bring to life the kinds of things that the previous panels talked about. And then I also was wondering about insurance. I know not only ACA, but in Oregon, we passed a law saying that insurers had to pay for applied behavioral analysis. So I don't know if your struggles with insurance were before that. If it was after that, I'd really like to know that.
Well, before and after, actually, because the state, you know, did ask forced our insurance company to then pay for services. So they began a process of every 6 or 7 months sending us letters saying that our services would be cut unless we could prove that our child was disabled to the level that he was disabled. So we'd send in all of the information that we'd send in the month before or the 6 months before, and then we would get a letter saying that the doctor, the reviewing physician had reviewed our files, and it showed that our child was not as disabled as he had been previously. So then we would have to send the medical records in again, and then they would say, our mistake, and then restore the services. So we've had that happen to us maybe 4 times.
No. So thank you for that. Just to follow up, you may know that the insurance division at DCBS just did a data call on behavioral health kinds of issues, and one of the things that they've zeroed in on is autism, to look at how different insurers are reimbursing or rejecting claims, and they've not released that information yet. But they're analyzing it right now, so, you know, stay tuned. It's a big area of concern. But thank you. I agree with the comment about, you know, every time I think I'm tired, I can't even blame it on kids anymore because mine are all gone. But every time I think I'm tired in this session,
it's us
fighting for to support your kind of services, you know, I will remember you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. And thanks to all that took today. Yeah, I think this is, again, in the great presentation.
Quick question, Mr. Chair. Did Superintendent Rexford leave the building, or?
He has another meeting here. Okay.
I was going to try to drag him up. I was going to try to drag him up to talk about the, from a superintendent standpoint, what that need and finances are.
So for your benefit, I believe part of the reason the speaker created this committee is just for these kinds of conversations. And it happens that I also serve on the education sub where the budgets will be discussed. So
Yay.
Part of my goal in all these discussions, too, is to hear this and get that, because at least I'll be able to advocate at that level for these budgets. So
thank you.
So good system.
How convenient.
Mm-hmm. Convenient.
Chair. If you saw on the, I just wanted to add, you know, we do get 1%, a little bit less. Early intervention, early childhood special education can bill Medicaid for certain services, and we do maximize that as much as we can. The issues with using health care insurance, you have to have a certain kind of provider, so it's somewhat of a match, but you also want to be careful in that process not to stress families out by forcing them to go to clinic after clinic after clinic to piece together services. Mm-hmm. But we do currently bill Medicaid, so there's an educational piece.
Mm-hmm. Representative Brock-Smith.
Thank you. So since you put it that way, Mr. Chair, in the educational subcommittee and how things are going and funding, just to point out again the investment early and how much you're saving in the long run. And at some point, as a state, we have to look at that, right, so that we can shift into the early investment. It's going to take 10-15 years to get there, right? But, let's start now.
Thank you. And thanks again for all of you for being here. So I'm going to close the informational hearing. And I'm going to open a work session for the purposes of introducing.
I was tired planning to keep their service.
Many bills.
I didn't say tired kicking the
okay.
Webinar. I'm not done.
So, are you going
to? I'm happy to introduce.
Okay.
Them. Okay. Chair Lively, I move that the following legislative concepts, where is that what the LCs are, right?
Yeah.
Thank you. Be introduced as committee bills. LC 3842, dated 1/26/17. LC 3844, dated 1/26/17. LC 3846, dated 1/26/17.
I know.
LC 3847, dated 1/26/17. LC 3848, dated 1/26/17. LC 3849, dated 1/26/17.
So, committee members, these were the placeholders, and we're introducing now bills, so we still have a mechanism in which to move things since the deadline is Tuesday. Okay? So, Rep. Peluso moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 3842, dated 1/26/17. LC 3844, dated 1/26/17. LC 3846, dated 1/26/17. LC 3847, dated 1/26/17. LC 3848, dated 1/26/17, and LC 3849, dated 1/26/17. Is there any discussion? If not, the measures will be introduced as committee bills. Anything else to come before the committee? I'll remind you that on March 2nd, we're going to do a committee. Members are going to get to do a bigger dive, and we're hearing a lot of information, so there's a lot of things. And so my goal, again, as chair, and since I serve in the education sub, is to get pretty clear consensus and direction from this committee so we can advocate as best we can. But we'll start off with looking at the metrics of the hubs and that. Most people that presented like they did today really showed us what those results are and what they measure, but we want to make sure we focus on that to understand and some of the other issues. So, Representative Peluso.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Lively. So, my office is looking at the court care concept as a potential committee bill. So we'll come back the first of the week with some information around that. It's bottom line, it is providing child care for children whose parents are on trial, basically, and so that they don't have to hear some of these horrific stories that are attached to that, so that this would be providing that court care. And I'm anticipating a pretty small fiscal ask on that. It'll be a pilot project, so but we'll have more information the first of the week around that.
And anything else? Okay. Not, we'll adjourn. Okay. Not, we'll adjourn.